very interesting sort of indie documentary called The High Price of Low Cost that you might be interested in if you haven't seen it already. Back to net.
Yeah, I think that was a PBS program, but I'm not sure. The High Price of Low Cost. The good news of Walmart is that they buy things in huge amounts. Therefore, they're getting really cut rates. And so they've got a lot of stuff you can select in their store at very attractive prices. That's the good news. The bad news, once that store has moved into your town, they have displaced a whole lot of mom-and-pop stores that were there for many generations. They get displaced, and a significant number of people now working for Walmart are working at minimum wage. In many cases, they're below the poverty level. A significant percentage of, say, for instance, New York City right now, those people are living below the poverty level. And that's less than desirable. I think there's a recent book on the subject of the runaway inequality that's going on with our economics these days. There's a significant number of people saying there's no longer a middle class. We've got rich people and poor people, and a hell of a lot of people have been pushed into poverty because of the way we've set up minimum wage. And there's a lot of discussion on that particular one. Should the minimum wage be $8 or $15? There are people claiming that the whole world will come to an end if we set the minimum wage at $15. But to have people who work a 40-hour week and still are living below the poverty level because of the salary they get, there's something wrong with that system as I see it. There's got to be room for improvement here. And it's not an easy one to solve. I know we're getting pretty far left of center. Let's see now. Rich has another question he wanted to ask. N2EO, K2LAW. Go ahead, Rich.
NY2HF for the comments on that.
Yeah, stand by, Rich. We're still on that subject. Go ahead with your comment, Dennis.
Actually, it gets more insidious than Walmart, because what you have actually going on that nobody's talking about is have people who have built up, mostly the older generation, have built up their assets, and they're chipping away, giving it to their children, and you know, it's diminishing return, because we're taking away from what we for our lifetime, giving away to our kids, because they get really screwed, and you know, we're chipping away at everything we ever had. So I don't know how to explain it, actually articulate it much better. But so what's happening is that the older generation is giving to the younger generation, and you know, we're actually giving away our life jacket. Back to net.
And to you with the comment.
Yeah, West recognized, and I agree with you, Dennis. And as I said, there's a recent book that was outlined by way of one of the PBS programs recently, and I think the title is something along the lines of Runaway Inequality. The economics that has occurred in the last couple of decades are such that an awful lot of people are working a 40-hour week, and they're working below the poverty level, and they're enthusiastically working and just can't get ahead. So, Warren Buffett, for instance, is saying, how in the world have we set up the economy in such a way that my secretary pays more taxes than I do? He is a multi-billionaire. I think he's worth something like $50 billion, and his secretary pays more in tax than he does. Something ain't quite right about that whole situation. Wes, what comment have you got on all these jobs? If you were going to straighten out the economy, what would you do? And how would you accomplish that one, Wes?
I have a comment on this topic.
Okay, we're going to go to John after Wes. And to XJN with a brief comment. K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Is this the political, social, economic computer network?
No, it is not.
Yeah, we can.
This is just an interesting question. I see it like we take Walmart, and that's the middle of the line of the problem. Then we have problem with people losing job or working for minimum wage. Instead of that, why don't we ask the question, why is that happened? Why Walmart is able to drive the prices down? Is it because President Clinton started with NAFTA, opened up the market for South America, which never worked, and then it was open road for the businesses to seek cheap employment. There is nothing wrong with people trying to make money, make a buck. But the problem is that the more the business goes to China, the cheaper the labor makes the product, and Walmart is able to sell it. The only way is just put the taxes on the products from outside. Now you're going to have your labor, and now there will be no need for the company to go
guarantee And when you go and buy one for, you know, your bathroom in Home Depot, and you get it home, it's such a cheesy piece of junk compared to the original manufactured one, which does cost more money. That's just a small idea, Dick. Back to you. KC2WGB.
NY2HF for the comment.
Yeah, Dennis recognized, and Peg's going to come first. Yeah, what you're saying, John, is buyer beware. By some means, we have to become educated as to what is the real quality of the thing that we're buying. Just because it looks good, just because the price is right, doesn't mean it's necessarily the one you want to buy. Peg, one of the things that you've got to know about with your particular radio is that either the amount of PL is a little bit low and it's slow to pick up, or whatever. You've got to squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then talk. I suddenly realized that every time you sign in, I hear the last two letters of your call letter, and I was having trouble hearing the rest of it because it wasn't there. WA2, which I normally don't hear, YBZ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Peg.
Yes, thank you, Dick, for the suggestion on methods. I'm on my mobile, and I'm also just being a little bit shy, so I'm probably taking the mic a little too quickly. Just with a follow-up, let me drop. Appreciated your feedback, John, about Walmart. I hadn't actually heard the term derivative product, but we've certainly been victim to that in our family, going in for higher name brands and ending up with a much poorer quality and having to make some phone calls. We've seen that too. I have another quick comment, and it's actually just about the chat. Let me drop. Hopefully it's okay to jump into that topic real quickly. It's just a quick question. Back to Nat.
Go right ahead, Peg.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Is the purpose of the chat to kind of line up a few questions for the net, or is it sort of an internal dialogue just between people who are listening? How is that ideally set up, just so I use it properly? Back to you.
The original intent of the TechNet was that the first hour would be people signing in with questions of a usually ham radio nature that are easy to discuss. And later on, at the tail end of the TechNet, we dug into deeper subjects. That was the original intent. I've also got a philosophy that I'm not trying to be the master controller of everything. We go with the flow. There are times when the first hour's worth of TechNet got onto some particular hot subject, like proper grounding of the 110-volt wiring of a house, a very simple-sounding subject, and proper grounding of the coaxial cables and the antennas and the radio tower. There are times we get on a subject like that, and tremendous number of people pile in saying, you got to do it this way, I did it that way, and it didn't work, and I changed over to this way. A very simple-sounding subject, sometimes that particular subject went on for a ridiculous amount of time. Well, but when people have got the enthusiasm to want to discuss it, and they're telling us their life experience in that area, what worked and what didn't work, even though we've gone beyond the allocated so-called 1 hour for that particular section of the TechNet, I let it go. I mean, there are people who are very unhappy about the fact that we don't keep a typed schedule. Well, if we're transferring good information back and forth, and a lot of people want to jump in and give us their comments, you don't want to stop a thing like that with that kind of enthusiasm. You don't want to squelch that enthusiasm. That's a philosophy of mine. I also have a philosophy. There's no such thing as a dumb question. The dumb question represents the biggest gap between what the guy knows and what he wants to know. Let me drop it. And therefore, the dumb question really is the one most deserving of an answer. We try not to have an elitist attitude of, that subject, that question of yours doesn't come up to the level of our discussions here. You're not worthy of discussing that particular subject, if you know what I mean. We try not to do that. Dennis, I think you wanted to straighten this all out on all of the above. NY2HF, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I'm going to try. Actually, John had a really good point. What happens when you go to Home Depot or Lowe's and you buy a John Deere or you buy, you know, something else that's name brand? They chop them down to make it as cheap as they can, so that when you walk into a Home Depot, you buy this John Deere for a really good price. But the really good price is not actually a John Deere. It's actually what they've had to cut out of it, make it appear on a Home Depot or Lowe's floor. So it's really a cheapened product that you're not going to be happy with. It's going to break down. And it actually cheapens whoever the name brand is, manufactures it, really cheapens what their brand is. So that's just what I'm trying to say. I bought a few things from different places, and I said, oh, this is a really good brand. And got it home and had one problem after another. So if you go into a John Deere dealership and you buy John Deere, there's a difference between what you buy at the Home Depot or Lowe's or anything else. Back to net. Thank you.
Further comment on derivatives?
Yeah, I'm gonna eventually pass it back to you. This is a pretty complicated. Really, what is the quality that we're buying? There's got to be some way we can find out what we're really doing, and whether or not Home Depot is doing it right or not. As you know, we've got a guy who signs in very frequently, Vito, W-A-2-P-J-F, who has worked faithfully for Home Depot for some period of time, and he's a guy that's conscientious enough to go to all of their classes where they teach you how to properly service the customer and understand their questions and give them the information that they need. So when it comes to the subject you're discussing right now, next time Vito is around, we got to ask him what's the way around what you're discussing. So somehow, when we're getting something, when the deal is too good, sometimes the deal is too good, if you know what I mean. You got to be wary, and there's got to be some kind of a way that we can find out what are we really buying, and whether or not that vendor will stand behind that customer, stand behind that product if you run into a problem. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead.
K2WGB. Quick explanations on how the derivatives got started. Many years ago, when we had mom-and-pop appliance stores, we were going to pick appliances because it's easy, and they'd have washing machines and dryers and things like that. Well, when the big stores came in, which were like a large department store or a large dealer who bought a lot of stuff, they could sell it cheaper. So how did they make it even? What they did was they took an exact same model and changed the model number slightly so that you couldn't really shop it. It was a different model they were talking about, and then they could embellish it and say, well, it has this or that. Whether it did or not, there was a way to work around it to help out the smaller dealers. But now they've turned it around where they're actually making derivatives for the large stores that can afford to have them change the production line. But that's how derivative models started, and it just became something I think is unfair because, like you say, the educated consumer, who would realize that that's going on? You know, you buy a product that has a model number that's similar, looks identical, you're going to think it's the same product. So, you know, it's kind of silly. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
YBZ with a comment.
Yeah, Peg recognized. And again, we've only heard the last three letters. That model number, which is a great big long number, and it's hard to memorize and hard to recognize when there's a small change in that number, it really represents a brand new product. By way of the internet, is there a way that I can check that model number on the internet and find out whether or not I'm getting a derivative or I'm getting the real product? Is that the method by which, if we're willing to do a little bit of research, we can find out what we're about to spend our hard-earned money on? What's the suggestion on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech end.
Dick, my first impression would be it would be very difficult to find out. They don't want you to know. The only reason I found out was actually comparing the two products when I removed the old one, looking at the new one. And I said, and I called up Moan, and I was complaining to them. They did not give me the answer. I went to the supply house, the plumbing supply house, and I got the original one that I had. Well, when I called Moan back and had the discussion, then I was told that was a derivative model. And I think it was only a question of like an A after it or a letter change. That's all at the end. And the model number was only maybe 4 or 5 digits, but that's all the change was. And that's kind of unfair, in my opinion. Back to you, Dick.
When you first talked to Moen, are you telling me that they were not allowed to give you that information until you found out enough and directly questioned them? They wouldn't admit that they were involved in a derivative product manufacture? Is that sort of what you're saying, John? Go ahead.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Dick. Exactly what I'm saying. But when I called them back with that information at the supply house and that slight difference of the letter or whatever after it, then they told me, oh, that's something special manufactured for Home Depot. And I said, well, I asked that specific question and you said they were identical. And that's when they backed down and that's how I found out. It's kind of a tough route to go. They should be forthcoming, more forthcoming, I believe. You know, straight up.
Yeah, the trouble is that particular guy you talked to, John, between a rock and a hard place. He's involved in the manufacture of a product for a major customer of theirs, Home Depot, and they are not allowed to say disparaging remarks about that particular model number of that particular product without him being fired because he's violating the rules of his chain of command and his organization. How do we become informed? That's a tough one. Let's see if Peggy can give us better information on how we can become better informed. WA2YBZ, K2LAZ, you're good, Peg.
Yeah, no, I'm just listening with interest to all the terms and the feedback. We've all had that experience where you go in to buy a DeWalt drill or something and you end up with something that's lesser. It's like the companies are knocking themselves off under their own name, which is, it's all very strange. I can't actually offer any insights. I just had a quick follow-up about the chat whenever you're ready to get back to that. Thanks.
Yeah, go ahead with your quick follow-up, Peg. And it doesn't have to be super quick.
Okay, thanks, Nick. So I think what you were saying, the original intent of the chat was to, if I understood you correctly, handle the overflow of feedback when there was sort of a hot topic. Was that correct? Back to you.
I think you're asking me, what did I mean when I said that? And you think I know? We play it by ear. Yeah. Most of the time, we have a kind of a loose schedule we stick to. In the first hour, our general ham radio questions that are answerable in a limited amount of time. That's the usual schedule, followed by mailbag, followed by the space report. That's the usual schedule. From time to time, though, when people get into, when the crowd that has assembled, when this erudite group has come together and they get real enthusiastic about some particular subject, I don't stop them. I mean, if enough people have enough enthusiasm and their education is taking place, information is being transferred, you don't want to interrupt that. So I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in with questions. We're an hour and a half into the TechNet, and we're coming up very close to the time we should go over to the mailbag. Anybody object to me going over to the mailbag at this time? Speak now or hold your peace for the next hour. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, you forgot about me, Dick, and Tweel.
Okay, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I did have a question, but first, two quick comments. I know what you're saying about the derivatives, but I don't want to see government control, which scares me. That's what, you know, government control is what they did, heavy government control in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. So I definitely don't want to see that. The other thing is, if anybody's interested, I have a reverse mortgage on my home. It's good for some. terrible for others. It's for anybody interested. Call me on the computer. I can give more information. And anyway, when I'm gone, the way I'm setting it up, hopefully Patricia will get the house. She's 10 years younger than me. And when she's gone, her son can either buy back the mortgage or take out whatever's left in equity and move. Either way. But that's the way we're setting it up with a will. For us, it's a very good thing. And question on fireplaces, talking about off-color, off-base subjects. Is that okay?
That's getting up fairly far left of center here. And there's a comment I wanted to make on something you just said. Oh, yes. When Ronald Reagan came into office, he came to the conclusion we had too much government control, and he made some serious moves to remove as much control as possible and to back government out of our lifestyle. I think his intention was generally good. However, when he removed an awful lot of the controls on the banking industry, look what happened in 2007. People were getting all kinds of commissions for selling liar loans, and we got into an awful lot of trouble because there wasn't enough control on banking industry, and I think it was Reagan that started that. So do we try to get more government, less government? You got to get the happy medium. You don't want to just slash and burn, if you know what I mean. Take away all controls just because you think too much government control is bad. You got to be careful with these things. Let's go over to the mailbag. John, KC2, WGB, I hope the mailbag has some nice, exciting questions, and it's not just somebody doing his college homework and asking us the question. Over to you, John, KC2, WGB, K2IW, the tech man.
More orange.
KC2, WGB, just wanted to make sure everything would reset there. Yeah, okay, well, I don't think anybody's doing their homework, but I have an interesting question on a Smith chart from a young gentleman who's trying to understand what's going on. So let me let it drop, and I'll give you his question. Okay, he's looking at a Smith chart, and he's talking about a telescoping monopole. And on the Smith chart, it'll show it's at 47 ohms or 40 ohms. Okay, so if he lengthens the monopole, he believes he's increasing the resistive component. But by doing that, he believes it's going to increase the inductive reactance. Thereby, he would have to add a capacitive reactance to counteract that. He wants to know if that thought is correct. And when you're playing with those small antennas, and he's dealing with, the VHF frequencies, I'd like to know ballpark air capacitor to use. Would a 350 picofarad do, or does he need less than that? What's your thoughts on that? Maybe you can give him a little instructions about that. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Okay, John, that's an example of a very good listener who's gotten an awful lot of the information that an awful lot of hams don't have. I've been saying it for some time. By way of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, this is where Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, when they were working for the RCA Corporation in 1945, they realized that the impedance of antennas, monopole and dipole-like antennas, the impedance as you sweep them in frequency or make them too long or too short or too large in diameter or too skinny in diameter, the real impedance of so-called simple antennas, where people are trying to predict that with an equation and coming up with equations that were working so poorly, they decided that the hell with this modeling effort, so to speak. They went and took a signal generator, a frequency meter, a slotted line, a slide rule, and a man year of their life, and they went and really measured the real impedance of monopole-like antennas, ground plane antennas, which, as you know, that's half of a dipole, so that's extremely valuable information. You just double it, and you know what you're going to get impedance-wise for a dipole. And what your reader has heard me say, and he's remembered it very well, let me drop it. make it physically longer, the apparent resistive component of impedance does become higher. That's one truth. Second of all, as you make the antenna longer, it becomes more inductive, less capacitive, more inductive, or more inductive. You're moving in that same direction. The majority of ham radio operators in the past, including me, did not know that. By way of those Brown and Woodward curves, that becomes very clear to you. Once you've decided to make the antenna longer because you don't like 40 ohms of resistive component, you want 50 ohms of resistive component, and you make it longer and you get 50 ohms. Because you've made it longer, you've made it more inductive, you picked up an inductive reactance. And if you're not going to do anything else to it, that's reasonably bad, because as you pick up reactance of your impedance of your antenna, the standing wave ratio starts going up pretty darn fast. But that is not a showstopper. Once you don't allow that to shock you into a submission, the fact that the antenna has become a little bit too inductive is an extremely simple solution to that. Add some capacitance to combat it. If you were physically able to put the capacitor in series with the radiator, you would get rid of the inductance in one simple step and it's gone. Let me drop. But there's a problem. To put a series inductor into something like a monopole or a dipole mechanically is darn complicated. You can't just simply take that telescoping whip and cut it off and put a capacitor in series with it and now reconstruct it and have the same physical strength. Therefore, you take the alternate approach. You're going to put capacitance in there to get rid of the inductance you've created by making it longer to go from 40 ohms to 50 ohms. The capacitance doesn't have to be in series. It can be in parallel. That's the good news. The bad news is you get some interaction. As you put that capacitor in parallel and you're canceling some of the inductive reactants, it has a simultaneous action of readjusting the resistive component a little bit. Therefore, you're going to have to readjust the length. In other words, there's a little bit of a feedback mechanism. Instead of doing it all in one step, it's going to take you three or four slightly interactive steps. This is reasonably well explained in a 1,500-word article that you can read about at the www.amateurradio.tv, and you go to the articles by K2LIW, and one, there's an article in there about getting perfect impedance match to your dipole, and it'll give you a little bit more of the details. But he's got it right. Longer makes it higher in resistive component. Longer makes it more inductive, or less capacitive. You're moving in that direction on the Smith chart. And the fact that you've got inductance, don't let that stop you. By putting that capacitor to correct it in parallel at the base where it's convenient, you're moving in the right direction, but you're going to get some interaction. You're going to have to go back and forth between length and setting of the capacitor. Now, let me drop. By way of the Brown and Woodward curves, you could predict ahead of time how much extra length is going to be required to get you to go from 40 ohms to 50 ohms in this particular example. You could figure out exactly how much extra inductive reactance you're going to pick up. Therefore, you know how much capacitor reactance approximately you're going to be creating, and whether or not the particular variable capacitor you've got in your hand is going to be big enough, you could make a prediction ahead of time. But even if you don't do the process of making the prediction, and you put in that variable capacitor, and you find out it's not quite big enough, by the time you've fully meshed it and you've got the maximum capacitance out of it, and it's not quite enough, you've moved in the right direction, but you didn't go quite far enough, and now you know you've got to put more capacitance there. And does that mean you put in a bigger air variable, or you put another fixed capacitor across the air variable you've got? The choice is yours. So it's not going to suddenly explode because the one you put in wasn't big enough. And it's like the example I often give. It's a little bit like a blind man walking, a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. The tilt of his feet tells him when he's going in the right direction to go uphill. When you adjust that variable capacitor and you hit maximum or minimum and you see it getting better but you don't quite get to the sweet spot, the direction that you've moved tells you which direction you want to go further, and you'll eventually figure out how to get there. I know that's not quite the answer you expected, but hopefully it's helpful information. But to memorize in your head, longer is higher in resistance, longer is more inductance. That's the way general antennas behave, and boy, that gives you a lot of information that a Texas didn't have until recently. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the second half.
Very good, Dick. Good information. Yeah, I think he's going to have a real adventure with the Smith chart. He's been going through a few of them, and that was his concept. He just wanted to make sure he had it right. So it sounds like he's going in the right direction. Oh, okay. Let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one.
And by the way, one of the strongest pieces of information that gives you the operator concentrated information in a hurry is the fact that a vector network analyzer, modern day vector network analyzer, you can display the data you desire in a number of different ways. You can make it an XY plot where the horizontal axis is frequency and the vertical axis is standing wave ratio. Or you can make that vertical axis reflection coefficient. And by the way, when you set it up as reflection coefficient, as Joe W2RYY has been bringing to our attention, we set it up as reflection coefficient, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is a reflection coefficient of 9.5 or 10 dB. It's an easy number to remember. And if you really like a high performance and you want a 1.15 standing wave ratio, it's something like a 20 dB reflection coefficient. So when you're looking at reflection coefficient while you're tuning an antenna, and you're looking at the screen that way on your vector network analyzer or your scalar network analyzer, it gives you a hell of a lot of information with very high resolution in a hurry when you do it as reflection coefficient. But if now you want to really know, your antenna has got a 1.15 BISWAR. And is it a 1.15 BISWAR because you have a resistive mismatch or a reactive mismatch? All you know is the BISWAR is 1.5:1 if you're using your bird watt meter. And if you're able to display it on a Smith chart display of your vector network analyzer, now it's a little bit more difficult to get used to it and to understand what it's telling you, but boy, is it telling you a lot of information. It tells you by way of that dot, so to speak, moves on the screen. The 50-ohm resistive point is right the center of the screen of the Smith chart. That's home plate. That's the desirable place. You're trying to make the impedance go there. Let me drop. But as you're sweeping the frequency and you see that those dots in that line go away from the screen to the left, you know that the resistance is too low. Away from the center of the screen to the right, you know the resistance is too high. Away from the center of the screen too high, you know it's too inductive. Too low, you know it's too capacitive. So the position of that of your dot of that particular favorite frequency on that Smith chart of your vector network analyzer is giving you a hell of a lot of information in a hurry. You know exactly what you've got to correct. Is it the resistive component or the reactive component, and how much? So it takes some extra training to learn how to use that. But that machine can give you megabytes of information as a visual display in milliseconds, and most of the vector network analyzers operate fast enough that as you're waving your hand past the antenna while you're tuning it, and you watch the display move in a particular way, and as your hand gets near the tip of the antenna, and you're adding some extra capacitance, and you watch the display get better, you say, wow, that's the right direction. I got to do more of that. Maybe I've got to put a little extra lens, or I've got to put a piece of copper tape on the tip of the antenna for the time being to get a better information. The fact that you're seeing the display with such high concentration of information in real time, you'd be amazed how many times serendipity strikes. You wave a hand near the antenna, you see it either get better or worse, but the direction in which it gets better or worse, how fast it gets better or worse as you move your hand closer or further away from certain elements, that gives you the serendipity of that episode. As long as you're watching the screen and you know what you're seeing, that can give you a lot of information in a hurry, and you can find breakthroughs. A hell of a lot of the fancy antennas I've worked with.
Repeater, time out.
A hell of a lot of the fancy antennas I've worked on, the so-called breakthrough that made it work better, was one of those serendipitous situations. My hand waved near the antenna, I saw the display move in a particular way, and I said, wow, whatever we just did, we got to do more of it, and the antenna's going to get better. You try to do that by ordinary computer antenna modeling. you never would have found that. You do it as a ham radio tinkerer, where you're moving objects around the antenna while watching the display of the right kind of instrumentation. You can literally test 50 antenna designs in a day. By computer modeling, you'd be lucky to get two or three of the antenna designs and test it, and you wouldn't know whether or not you're going in the right direction until you're going through the great big process. Computer modeling of antennas. On certain kinds of antennas, it works like a charm. On certain kinds of very high-performance antenna, computer modeling works very poorly, and the schooling never tells you that. Almost every electronic engineer comes out of school thinking that he better do nothing but computer modeling and never really get his hands dirty with a real antenna. You walk out of a school with that opinion, and you're putting yourself at a huge disadvantage. Our instructors are leading our students in that direction. They believe they're doing the right thing. As you can tell, I've got a strong opposing opinion. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, yeah, very true, Dick. I've experienced that serendipitous events many times, and it's almost like you're cheating. It makes it so easy. And you're absolutely right. You bring your hand near it, you'll see that dot start to move to where you want it, or basically in the right direction. And maybe it doesn't move far enough, but at least you got an idea. Well, I need more capacitance near this element. But boy, it can save an awful lot of time. And one thing is good. The prices of the lower frequency spectrum analyzers, well, vector network analyzers or network analyzers, are coming down. So you can get something that works in the VHF region fairly reasonable, which is terrific. And I think more and more people are going to be using Smith charts and some of these network analyzers to understand what's going on. Okay, let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next one.
There's one more point I'm going to make on this one. I cut my teeth in the electrical engineering world fresh out of school with a bachelor's degree in the mid-60s. And time after time, somebody in the mid-60s doing laboratory testing, he goes and gets a signal generator, he goes and gets a frequency meter or a frequency counter, he goes and gets an oscilloscope and a crystal detector, he goes and gets a directional coupler. Time after time, you're assembling all of these particular pieces of equipment on the lab bench in order to do a measurement. And somebody came along in those days and said, gee, we're always doing the exact same setup, time after time, where the signal generator you want may not be available because it's going back to the calibration lab. The oscilloscope you want may not be available because somebody else is using it. The detector you want, the directional coupler, the standing wave ratio bridge, the slotted line may not be available because somebody's using it. And somebody came to the conclusion that if we take all of those instruments and put them in one box, they didn't know what to call it in those days. They called it a composite test set or something like that. We eventually started to calling it what it really is, vector network analyzer. What the word vector means is that when you measure the strength of something that you're looking for, whether it be a signal or a force you're creating, if you measure the strength and you measure the direction, in the case of a force, that's a vector. A signal strength or a pushing force in a particular direction, we call it a vector. In the radio world, when you've got a certain magnitude of voltage at a particular phase angle, we call that a vector. So because this instrumentation, when you put all of these individual instruments in one box and hook it up correctly, it now can simultaneously measure the signal strength that you're looking for, whether it be the signal flowing through or the signal being reflected from an antenna. You're measuring the strength of the signal and the phase angle. That's called vector. That's why it eventually got called vector network analyzer. So it's really a whole bunch of individual pieces of test equipment in the old world, all put into one box, in the old days, all put into one box and properly used with the right kind of microprocessor. So it now sweeps across all of your frequencies that you care about 30 times per second, which means you get no flicker on that screen. And at each one of those stops, at each one of those individual megacycles it's stopping on and making a measurement because of its very fast operating. Let me drop it. It's very fast operating frequency synthesizer, And it knows, because you've gone through the calibration procedure, that each one of those frequency stops, it has to add this correction factor to correct for your particular length of cable with your particular improperly installed connector on the length of that cable that created some standing wave ratio in your test cable. But because you put the right kind of a calibration kit at the end of that test cable when you did the cal procedure, the machine knows from its memory, its stored memory, what correction factors to use on each and every one of those, let's say, 100 frequencies you're sweeping across 30 times per second. That computer in there is really grinding out a hell of a lot of information, doing all of that correction, all of that fast display, giving you that display 30 times per second updated on that screen. You don't even see the flicker. From your point of view, it looks like everything is in real time. Can you see how a man-year's worth of work that Mr. Brown and Woodward did to measure all the impedances of monopole antennas of various lengths and various diameters, they spent a man-year of work doing that. With a modern-day vector network analyzer, they could have done all of that in 2 days. What an advantage you've got these days. KC2WGB, K2RIW for TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, you're absolutely right. I can't imagine what a job that must have been. They must have been cursing at each other. But a lot of work. But, you know, I noticed, since we've been talking about the network analyzers and the equipment, I've gotten a lot of hits on the QRZ page and in the emails about the equipment. And, you know, a lot of people are out there looking for the stuff on eBay and other areas. So people are looking to acquire the nice stuff. And I'm sure they're going to have fun with it. And I say, go ahead, do it. It's well worth it. All right, let me let her drop the button. Welcome to the next one.
You would be able to explain vector signal analyzer and vector network analyzer different.
Okay, this next young ham here, or scientist, I don't know what he is in his early high school days. Okay, he has a question. He's heard you speak about skin effect, and he understands DC is distributed throughout the wire. He wants to know why, as the frequency goes up, conduction only happens on the outer skin of the conductor when you get to very high frequencies. As you said, it's in the thousands of an inch, the conduction area. What actually causes that? What's going on? He'd like to know the physics of what's happening there, Dick. Back to you. KC2WGB.
This is not an easy one to explain. It involves Faraday's law and Lenz's law. If I put a shield around, say for instance, a 60-cycle transformer, which is radiating some strong magnetic field, and I want to shield it, if I was using the right kind of instrumentation, I could find out from the instant of time that you close the switch and the 110 volt is applied to the primary of the transformer, and the transformer is starting to build up a magnetic field. The magnetic field coming out of the transformer is pretty darn fast. Because I've put a shield around the transformer, and I'm now making measurements of the magnetic shield on the outside of that shield, how much magnetic field gets there, you'll realize there's an extra delay. Because the rate of change of the magnetic field, in this example, is by way of Faraday's law, that magnetic field that's changing is hitting a conductor. It could be the wire of the secondary winding of a transformer, and that's how the transformer works. The rate of change of magnetic field, by Faraday's law, induces a voltage in that winding, and with that transformer action. Well, in this case, it's not a winding, it's the metal conductor of a shield, and still the Faraday's law means that you're inducing a voltage in that shield, but the shield is a completely six-sided box around my transformer, and now that shield represents a short-circuited turn. And so now the rate at which you can build up the voltage on that direction, the magnetic field on that short-circuited turn, is being slowed down by Lenz's law. Lenz's law tells me that when I'm operating a transformer, the voltage rate of change caused by the primary winding, that's inducing a voltage in the secondary winding. If I start putting a short circuit across that secondary winding.
Repeater, timeout.
As I start putting a short circuit across that secondary winding, you could say that the short circuit means that extra current is flowing in that secondary winding into that short circuit. That current in the winding is flowing in such a direction that it is bucking, it is opposing the rate of change of the magnetic field. That's Lenz's law. As you're trying to induce a voltage because of your rate of change of magnetic field into a winding, and the winding is resisting it, it's a short circuit, and you're inducing a current, the direction of the current is such that it resists the rate of change of the magnetic field. And that magnetic field can't be built up as fast in that secondary winding. The primary winding is trying to crank out that magnetic field. It senses the fact that something is stopping it, and it's therefore got to work harder, and that's the reason why the primary current increases. So you take an ordinary one-to-one transformer, for instance, an isolation transformer. Let me drop one. And you put a load across the secondary winding, the current that you put into the primary winding increases. At first you say, yeah, that's simple conservation of energy. But let's go one step deeper. What's really going on here? That primary winding is generating a rate of change of magnetic field on that AC voltage you've applied to the primary winding. That's trying to, that rate of change of magnetic field is inducing a voltage in the secondary winding. If the secondary winding is open circuited, it has no trouble doing that. And you get very little extra current in the primary winding. That's just the so-called magnetization current of an open circuit transformer. And how much current flows into the primary winding in an open circuited transformer is strictly a function of whether or not you put the right number of turns into the primary winding, where you're not saturating the core and so on. But as you start loading down the transformer, secondary winding, the primary knows about it because of Lenz's law. So you can see how there's a delay in the rate of buildup of magnetic field created by that short circuit. Okay, that's a short circuit on a secondary winding, or it's the kind of short circuit made by a six-sided box as a shield around a transformer. You could say that I would like the wire that my radio signal is traveling down. Let me drop it. I would like all of the diameter of the winding to carry the magnetic current. To carry the current, the RF current that I'm putting into that wire. I'd like the total circumference of the wire, the total cross-sectional area to be active. However, that RF voltage that you're inducing onto that wire of your antenna, for instance, it sees the outer layer of the wire as a kind of a short circuit. The magnetic field that you're trying to induce into that wire of your antenna, it has to try to penetrate to the center of that wire. It has to get through that short circuit, so to speak, of the outer layers. I know this is not a real good explanation. I'm trying to explain a so-called skin effect. The bottom line of all of this is that you can go to an equation that will tell you how much conductivity does your material have, what's the frequency you're operating at, and you can make a prediction. And the way it usually works is that most of the frequencies we care about, the RF energy you put onto that wire of your antenna, only the last 10,000th of an inch is conducting the majority of the current. The rest of the cross-sectional area of that wire isn't doing anything for you. Let me drop it. Because that radio signal has to get through that outer layer of conductor that it views as a kind of a short circuit in order to get down to the meat of the center of that piece of wire. There's a delay time in it getting there, simply similar to that delay time of the magnetic field building up in the secondary winding of your transformer because you've shorted out the secondary winding. So you go to a low enough frequency, it now has the time to get there and you're using the full cross-section of a wire. As you start getting to the very large diameter wires that carry 5,000 amperes of current, believe it or not, even at 60 cycles, not all the current can get to the center of the winding. You're even getting a minor amount of skin effect. At 60 cycles, these great big chunks of wire that you've used in your business, John, you'll find out if you made a careful measurement that the rate of current flow through the outer skin is probably 50% higher than the current that's flowing through the center of that wire, even at 60 cycles. but by the time you get up to a megacycle, or 3.5 megacycles of 80 meters, only the last 10,000th of an inch of the outer conductor of good conductors are doing all of the conducting. Let me drop. As such, if you're building an antenna where you think you need a 1-inch diameter conductor in order to get your particular bandwidth, your particular current flow and whatever, and you're operating in a number of megahertz, you can really make that a very thin-walled copper tubing and save all that copper in the center because it wasn't doing you any good at RF frequencies because of the skin effect. There's a lot of ways of looking at this. It's not an easy one to understand. And but skin effect is something that's darn important. It gives you an extremely good benefit. You can put your hand across a circuit that has a lot of RF energy on it. Because of the skin effect of your body, the RF energy is only flowing along the first thousandth of an inch of your skin, doesn't penetrate into the center where it gets into the blood supply and electrocutes you. You put your hand across a 100-volt pair of terminals at 60 cycles, and you're at the threshold of becoming electrocuted. You put your hand across a pair of terminals that are carrying a 3.5 megacycle signal, the skin of your hand will sense some heating, but the RF current doesn't get down to very far below the skin, and therefore you don't get electrocuted. You'll get a burn on your skin, but you won't get electrocuted. There, the skin effect, which is normally a detriment when it comes to the wire of an antenna, it is keeping you alive. Be happy to the skin effect. There's a hell of a lot of times when you and I have touched high voltage, high frequency circuits, John, and we got a burn on our finger, but we didn't get electrocuted because of the skin effect. It saved our bacon. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Gentlemen. KC2WGB. Very true, Dick. Very true. So, could he look at it in the sense that when the frequency gets higher and higher, the duration from reversing of the two poles, positive to negative, is so quick, that's where the time element of not allowing it to penetrate the conductor, is that the basic cause?
You got it, John. That's 90% of the story. That the high frequency it doesn't give it enough time to penetrate before the signal has already reversed in polarity. So skin effect is bad when you're building an antenna, per se, if you haven't designed for it, but it's an awful good safety factor when it comes to electrocuting human beings. I think Wes wants to make a comment on this. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Y2HF for the comment.
Dissipation. You need to really state it means you need, if you take the tubing, it works as well as the solid copper. The only thing is that then you don't have mass to cool. So in big powers, they actually put the water or liquid inside to cool a collection cable. Could you say a few words about it?
It turns out that the very high amounts of currents that flow into the winding of a shake table, there are very big environmental testing machines that are literally an extremely large loudspeaker. By that I mean the machine might be built like a loudspeaker. The cone is not there, but the rest of the magnetic structure of a loudspeaker is there, and it's moving a table, and that table might be 3 feet in diameter, and you screw down onto that table because there's a bunch of blind holes. You screw down your piece of electronics, and now you're going to give your piece of electronics shake, rattle, and roll by way of this environmental testing machine, where it can create a 1kc note at 50 g's of acceleration and shake the living daylights out of your piece of electronics to find out whether or not it's going to survive the launch on a Saturn V rocket, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Okay, that supersized loudspeaker has multi-kilowatt audio amplifiers firing it. Huge amounts of current are putting through that winding that's moving that armature, that's moving that speaker coil, so to speak. And in many cases, That is a piece of copper tubing with water flowing through it to keep it cool, because even though you've chosen a very large piece of copper tubing, which has got a lot of current capability, still the amount of current you're putting through it is creating heating, and to make sure it doesn't become overheated, pouring water down the center. Similarly, there are ham radio operators that will take microwave tubes like a 2C39, 3CX.